Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au. Struggling to find tomorrow's breakout stocks on the ASX? With thousands of listed businesses, knowing how to spot the next rising star is hard. The Intelligent Investor Australian Equity Growth Fund cuts through the noise and invests in highly profitable owner-operated businesses. While past performance doesn't indicate future performance, IIGF has delivered an impressive 12.4% annual return since launch in October 2020 up to the end of April 2024. Investors will gain exposure to a concentrated portfolio of Aussie equities with considerable growth prospects. For a limited time, invest in ASX IIGF with zero brokerage fees directly with Intelligent Investor. Visit intelligentinvestor.com.au for details.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
Billy, welcome to the Australian Investors Podcast.
Hi, Howard. Thanks for having me.
It's my absolute pleasure, mate. It's not always that I get the chance to sit down with someone who has a real deep fascination for fundamental research and companies and how the world works from a business perspective, but then combines that with, you know, the ETF lens and portfolio management overall. So I'm going to have a lot of fun talking to you about AI and technology generally. GlobalX recently brought out the GXAI ETF, which is an ETF we will reference a few times throughout the show. But maybe because this is your first time, we do like to get to know folks who appear, and I hope that you will appear regularly on the show. And so I'm curious, can you just tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to where you are today?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Owen. So when people do meet me and they find out what I do with my tech specialists, they do expect some very interesting background. They do expect me to say I'm from a startup or I'm from a tech-driven family, but it's actually the opposite of that. You know, I came from a non-tech background. My family was business-driven, so I always knew I was going to be in some kind of investment area. I was trained as an accountant, and my strength was more numerical, more quant, more statistical. So I always wanted to go into this finance area, but in terms of technology focus, it was actually by chance. I joined the equity finance environment about 5 to 6 years post the tech bubble. That was the time when, I guess, no analyst wanted to cover tech. It was boring. You won't get client traction. And it was also the time when China was on its meteoric rise. Everyone wanted to cover China-related equities or China-related industries. So I got to pick the tech sector. And at that time, it wasn't even called the technology sector. It was called the TMT sector, if you recall. It was technology, media, and telecommunications. So it wasn't even technology itself. So early in my career, when I was covering this sector, what I really realized was I was the only analyst that actually got a lot of questions from internally. And the other analysts used to work by themselves. They wouldn't talk to each other. But I was the only analyst where you would see the property analyst, the conglomerate analyst, the transportation analyst coming to me going, "Hey, Billy, one of my companies just took a stake in your company. One of your companies just took a stake in your company." You know, there was some connection there. And I realized that. What I also realized was that my financial models were actually different from them. And it was a little technical, but if you look at my financial models in the tech space, we had a very interesting operating leverage that could come in about 5 to 6 years' time. And this was not evident in the other industries. So early on in this stage, I already realized there was something happening in tech. We were in an industry where it was spreading across sectors, even across geographies, and there was a chance where if this service picks up, you could actually be a huge leverage. So we moved on. We saw more companies getting listed, social media companies. Companies started making profits, and I guess pretty much everything was history after that.
Yeah. I've heard from Mark, who's appeared on the show, that
you're one of those types of people that if you're not doing anything else, like you are reading about companies, you're listening to transcripts and also reading transcripts or listening to analyst calls on 2x speed just to fit more in. Has that ever like worn off on you? Like what I mean by that is like sometimes the passion for investing, some people can lose it, but it seems like for you, that hasn't happened. And it's just continued to snowball.
Yeah, no, I think it's become part of my life. I enjoy doing it. I enjoy getting better at it as well. So I think it has become part of my life.
Yeah. So how did you end up then working on the ETF side? Like what led you specifically to GlobalX now?
Yeah, so a lot of my experience has been in sell side and buy side in equities. So in terms of active investing, I've had over a decade of experience. The last probably 3 years, I was more involved in high frequency trading in options and derivatives. So, to me, I've had a very long tenure in both active management and also high frequency management. And I guess what attracted to this role was looking at the passive investment opportunities and how that this could actually be a very good value growth opportunity for investors as well.
It's fascinating to me, Billy, because like I said, you kind of have that super deep bottom-up knowledge, but also the top-down from like the passive and the ETF side, which is like a real recipe, I must admit. So I'm sure we'll come back to how that experience has like interlaced with what you're doing now. But we're going to talk about AI. We're going to talk about different technology companies from right around the world. I'm curious to understand if AI has touched your life, like personally or professionally, and how you may be using these types of tools or the software in your day to day.
I often joke with my wife that we are going to outsource looking after our kids to artificial intelligence. I have two kids. And we do somewhat help them, with AI. So, for example, my kids sometimes would go to the Google and ask them about questions, which they don't know. They will sometimes even use ChatGPT. But what's interesting is it doesn't actually replace, what our parents could do. I mean, what actually happens is when they go and ask questions online, they actually come back to me or my wife and go, hey, I've learned about this. There's actually an interaction and engagement, and actually I learn as well from what they're trying to capture from the internet. So I thought, on a personal level, AI has actually helped improve relationships within families as well. And this was a very good case study and example. But I'm more serious though, I guess in a professional, there's actually a very huge scope for artificial intelligence. And I don't think anyone can doubt how much ChatGPT has helped in everyday work life. And for me as an analyst, it's helped huge. So it's not replacing what I do, or it's not simply making my job redundant, but it's helping me much more efficient. So an example of this is as an analyst, when I'm looking at certain investment theories or investment cases, I have a very strong view on hypothesis. And I think that's the hard part of any analysis, getting that hypothesis right. And when you have a hypothesis, the next part is the methodology of how to investigate it. And this usually requires a lot of time, whether or not it's gathering data, thinking what data together, or where to start. And this is where ChatGPT could come in, and which has helped me greatly. So I would go to ChatGPT, go, okay, I have this hypothesis. Where should I go? Is this the right course of progress to look into it? And it has helped me greatly. It's made me a much stronger analyst and much more efficient analyst as well. Mm-hmm. And I think lastly, it's interesting because, for artificial intelligence, it's actually in everyone's life right now. Whether or not if you're looking for food, looking for something to watch online, or even watch what to buy, everything's ingrained in artificial intelligence through algorithms. So it is very much part of our personal and working life as well.
I'm curious just quickly how you think that it might change the role of traditional stock research. If we just think about fundamental analysis in its purest form of like a quote-unquote value investor, have you thought about that much?
Yeah, so I think it goes into not just for analysts, but a lot of different kinds of industries or applications of this as well. My overarching answer for that is that with the use of AI, the time to market is going to be much faster. So whether or not it's going to be a service, but in answer to your question, our analysis as a research or fundamental analyst is going to be much faster and quicker. okay? And this is going to have the obvious impact on the market as well. So I would say that the biggest thing that I've seen now is the time to market of an analysis to actual actioning it. And you know, it has been apparent, obviously, with all this high-frequency trading and with all this market volatility, it's very evident that this is what's happening.
Yeah, right. That's fascinating. So I'm hoping that you can give us like a broad overview of the AI landscape, because I know this has been something that you've spent a lot of your early days at GlobalX doing and thinking about. Because I came across a number that suggested that at least 50% of businesses are either already using, like deliberately using AI tools, or plan to use AI tools in some way. So this landscape is obviously incredibly vast, at least for someone like me or anyone listening to this. We just think there's so many companies doing so many different things, and there's a bunch of buzzwords that go along with that. So maybe if I could ask you just to kind of narrow it in some way, or how you just think about the landscape in terms of what you mentioned to me something off air before, like you said something like upstream or downstream, like just how do you broadly think about the AI landscape and the key trends that are emerging?
Yeah, I think obviously it's a very sort of big question, but I think first of all, I do somewhat agree with that adoption rate that 50% of companies are using AI in some form. And it was similar to one of the studies that I've read that they surveyed a large amount of CIOs, and close to 70% of the CIOs said that AI is actually having a significant impact on the budget, on the IT budget in this year going forward as well. So this is quite significant and quite on par with what you just mentioned. And what's interesting, especially from observation, is that if you look at the earnings results call, or even the prepared remarks of these companies, the mention of artificial intelligence has risen substantially. So it's obvious that, you know, in terms of the investment landscape, not just from an investor, but also from corporates, this has become significant. But I think the key thing to really note right now is that the investment in AI from the corporate standpoint is still very much about operational efficiency. So it's about improving the company's efficiency through automation, through streamlining tasks and processes. We're still at that stage. I really want to let everyone know or flag that this is still very early stages. We are not yet at the stage where artificial intelligence, to me, a power vision is creating a new product, creating a new service. I think that's where we get to closer to maybe a more monetizable or commercializing stage. But right now, it's more about improving operational efficiency. And we are going to continue seeing that at least for a few years before we are going to get to a much more interesting stage of artificial intelligence.
I was just listening to the Apple quarterly call, most recent one, and that was probably something that was less, I guess, in terms of there was less AI terminology thrown around in comparison to, say, like Google or Microsoft, which seemed to have just sprinted straight into it. But I guess a lot of people that are listening to this are not just thinking from, like you said, like a chief information officer's or a CIO's perspective. They're also thinking at it from a perspective of like, I'm a consumer, how can this help me in some way? And we've had a lot of fear amongst people. I don't know if you remember this, Billy, but I remember when we had those automated cash registers first come out, and everyone thought to themselves, that's it. Woolworths going to have no staff. You know, Coles are going to have no staff. You know, we're all kind of doomed, and that completely didn't happen. But I'm curious to understand if you think there are certain technologies or pockets of the consumer landscape that we should be aware of in our everyday life that might evolve from this technology.
Yeah, sure. And so stop me if I'm going too far or if I'm thinking too far ahead. But there is a few things which I think is already happening, but it's actually not the full potential of artificial intelligence. And the first one is something that we touched upon when I mentioned I was outsourcing AI to my kids was voice assistants. So, you know, we've got Google, we've got Siri, we've got Alexa as well. So these are very, mainstream products right now. But if you look at these products, they're still very passive. So there are only a certain number of actions that they can actually perform, and they can't perform outside of this. So in my view, the voice assistant full potential actually will come from a development where these will be much more reactive. You come outside, you wake up, they'll know the weather, they'll suggest what you wear, they'll suggest what you catch a train or not, And they'll suggest what kind of breakfast she eats. So it's a very reactive to the environment that you are in and the day and the, you know, the how you know, you the sort of schedule of your day as well. So I think this is one of the next generation development of voice assistants. Another thing is AI cars or AI vehicles. Again, right now, the current development is very much on full selfless driving. So if you can just go into your car and not drive. But what I see is the next step of development is how can this help people that can't drive? Or how can this improve road congestion? I think these are the key potential. And I think lastly, it's also about content as well. We know that obviously when you watch Netflix, when you listen to Spotify, there's a lot of machine learning that's learning your behavior, pushing what you want. But I also envision a future where the consumers will be looking at content which is AI developed. I mean, can you imagine a movie which is AI scripted, AI casted, or even a whole entire movie which is created by AI, potentially winning the Oscars or Golden Globe? So I think right now we're still at this current stage where we're improving current potential, but the full potential is not there yet.
Mm. It's that's actually really interesting. You mentioned about movies and that type of a thing. I've been watching recently the Fallout series on, I think it's Amazon Prime, which for those that aren't aware, it's a little bit violent. It's a little bit of blood and gore, but it's I think it's one of the best series I've watched in recent times. And because I'm a big player of the video game, I absolutely love the Fallout video game. And I remember thinking about that many years ago, thinking, this is so complex. I just imagine to myself how hard it and like creative in two equal amounts that would be to create again, you know, to the effort that would go into that. And then I thought to myself, well, AI can probably do all of that, the heavy lifting. And as long as you have the creativity, you can kind of let that blossom. And, you know, taking that to the screen recently, it just brought it home for me how those two worlds are coming together, like the gaming world and the choose your own ending kind of Netflix series. And that I see that colliding in a big way where people might be able to pick their own ending or, you know, interact with the plot, I guess. So that was really interesting to me. But you did mention something off air when I was just talking to you about individual companies is that, you know, being upstream or downstream. We are seeing companies like NVIDIA, GPU design businesses, anything that's involved in that ecosystem, the cloud compute ecosystem. That is just finding a whole nother leg, and it's almost unbelievable. So I'm curious, like, the industry is massive. If we, depending on our definition, it could be as wide as we want it to be, really. But how do you think about the opportunities, the investment opportunities that may present for individuals versus, say, institutions, or just however you think about it?
Yeah. So I'll probably have to look back and, you know, I've seen a lot of technology, I guess, disruptions, whatever you call it. There's fancy words such as paradigm shifts. But what I've realized or what I've observed are that for like a successful technology shift or a successful innovation disruption, there must be a few factors in place, or there must be a certain trait that's a base requirement. And it's similar to what you mentioned. It must have a successful combination of a hardware level, enabler level, and an adopter level. And I think, you know, quickly defining is hardware. You need the companies manufacturing the hardware to actually excel or to make this technology possible. Yeah. And then you have the second layer, which are enablers, which are creating a foundational platform or infrastructure to allow the development or advancement of this technology, or lowering the barriers of entry so more participating companies can come in. And finally, you have a layer of companies that are the adopters, which are the ones that are going to leverage, piggyback on the infrastructure and create a new product and or service. And we've seen this before. The perfect example is one of those PCs. So you look at the PCs, we went through a time where Intel created one of the most powerful chips. So that set established the foundation for HP to create PCs. And that actually set the foundation for Microsoft to create Windows, a Microsoft productivity suite. I mean, it would not have been possible. There will be no Microsoft if not for for these hardware or enabling layers. And that's the same as internet, right? Internet, we have Intel producing incredible powerful chips, allowing for data transfer with Oracle and Cisco, creating that infrastructure for data to be transferred through the internet. And then you have Google, Amazon, incredibly creating a new product. So to answer your question, in terms of the AR landscape, we can also adopt the same methodology, looking at the hardware space, which is what you mentioned. We have the chip manufacturers and even going to the chip equipment manufacturers as well. We also have the enabling companies. We have a long list of cloud companies, not just Oracle and Cisco, but there's IBM. There's a lot of companies providing the cloud infrastructure for AI development. And this is the interesting part. The adopters, like I mentioned, is still very early stages. There is a lot of potential for companies to adopt AI and to leverage off AI to create that new service and to create that operating leverage that we are looking to see. And I think that's what the investment opportunities out there for everyone.
It's fascinating and fascinating that you break it apart into those three levels.
Sure.
And I remember thinking about this a few years ago. I was watching a presentation from someone and he was a big software investor, and he effectively said that the more abstraction you have, the further you get away from hardware, the more operating leverage that can kick in. Like you were mentioning before, in that your early days, like it dawned on you how valuable these technology companies could become if they hit that certain threshold where their operating leverage just takes off. A lot of what people are dreaming up at the moment really is like, how can this transform things like anywhere there's like a big data set? So healthcare, yes. Telecommunications, we've seen in cloud computing. I'm curious as you look across different sectors, if there are any in particular or industries or services or whatever, however you want to cut it up, that may, you know, give you an example of like a really good example for all of us, that illustrates kind of what you just said in that how you can play it in different ways.
I think that's a good question, mainly because a lot of people, when they talk about AI, we always talk about NVIDIA, Meta, Google, Amazon, and I always say, look, there's a lot of companies that are involved and benefiting, and you could actually make an investment case out of. And like you mentioned, healthcare has always been a space where I've really liked in terms of AI application because actually for the greater good. And for example, there is a company listed in the US called Zebra Technologies. They do a lot of diagnostic equipment, and they've actually applied AI in terms of medical and healthcare diagnosis. And they're also collaborating with NVIDIA and also another company called GE Healthcare Technology in all that medical imaging and diagnostics. And this has been huge for them. And they're already a $16 billion company, and it's not small. Yeah. We also have more, I guess, like you mentioned, hardware companies, more on the upstream, such as a company called Solistica, which is also a medical equipment manufacturer, but they've been applying AI to design, manufacture, and also operate these medical equipments, and these could range from very high-tech equipment, such as surgical equipment as well. So these are two companies which I thought was very interesting in the healthcare space. I guess in the finance space, we also see a few companies. One company which I quite like is called Datadog.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they're a cloud analytics company, and they've been doing a very good job in terms of securing data, analyzing data in the cloud space, and their clients include NASDAQ, London Stock Exchange, and many huge financial firms. And lastly, of course, we know about the entertainment industry, Netflix, even Snap. They've all been using AI to improve engagement, to improve user experience. And this has been showing in their annual reports and results as well.
Mm. So, Billy, one of the reasons that we're catching up today is we're talking post the launch of the GX AI ETF, and we're going to be doing a webinar where we answer people's questions on all different types of technology companies and AI. Many people will be familiar not just with the GX AI because we're getting so many questions about it when Mark was on a webinar about a week or two ago, but many people will be familiar with the suite of technology ETFs that GlobalX offers, whether it's FANG or N100, these types of ETFs that provide exposure to technology writ large, or in the case of FANG, like a really concentrated exposure. But for AI in particular, like if we're talking about all these individual companies and they seem to be doing great things, in your mind and given your background, what are the benefits of using an ETF that focuses on AI versus, say, going and picking the stocks?
It's a good question. And the way I would think of it is, obviously, I would think of it as, in, like we mentioned about how there's three layers in a technology innovative disruption. that encompasses a lot of different companies. But what I also think is we have to appreciate the amount of effort and different niches and focuses that needs to go in to actually build a technology disruption or innovation. And I'm sorry for sounding too nerdy or technical on this, but even on the hardware side, it's not just about NVIDIA chips. So one example is we have NVIDIA chips because it's part of machine learning. So machine learning is two parts. It's AI training and inference. So the training requires a lot of very powerful chips so we could run through a lot of different scenarios and teach the machines. But there's also a second part of the machine learning, which is taking a lot of demand right now, creating a lot of demand right now, is the inference part. And this is the part where we put the machines that we've just taught into testing. So we bombard the machines with all these different scenarios and data to see how they get inferred from what we just taught them. And this doesn't necessarily require very strong GPUs that NVIDIA makes. It actually requires a lot of memory chips. So this is where we go to the memory chip manufacturers such as SK Hynix, Samsung, both listed in Korea, Micron. These are the companies that's providing a lot of these memory chips. And just going deeper into hardware, just in equipment-wise, there's actually 15 types of equipment manufacturers for semiconductor chips that are each of their own field, each of their own niches, and there's different leaders in this field. So that's a depth that we are looking at. And even in the enabling space, the cloud space, it's not just about data management. We also have data analytics, data training. We also have IBM, which has been creating these different applications for third parties to analyze data. So actually, we have to appreciate that in all innovative investing, it's the breadth and the depth of what encompasses. So to answer your question, ETF is a very good way to gain exposure to artificial intelligence development. Is A, we're still at a very early stage, but B, and most importantly, it's so wide and it's so deep that we need to have that exposure around all these different segments and potentials to actually capture the opportunity.
That makes a lot of sense. And you're right. Like, it's just, I think if a lot of people just focused on the big household names, they might miss something that sideswipes them or something like this. In terms of ETFs themselves, Billy, like some people, and perhaps rightly so, do say that an ETF can be launched at exactly the wrong time. Like, it can come out when hype is at its highest or when there's a theme that's, you know, really a buzz. How do you think about that in terms of, you know, what should investors be looking for when they look at ETFs to capture some type of thematic, or they're putting it in their satellite allocation? How do you think about that, generally speaking?
Yeah. So for me, with my specialization in technology, what I really look for on the success of how to identify a successful technology theme is it's a few things. And I think this refers very strongly to what we see in AI, and I like to use AI as an example, is what I'm seeing for AI is maybe a convergence or a convergence of multiple favorable market factors. So one thing I'm seeing with this is that in terms of the technology advancement, it's been incredible the past decade. So not only are computing chips more powerful, but it's actually more affordable. So computing chip rates have increased by about tenfold in terms of computing power, but at the same time, the cost of these chips have come down 16 times. So this is very advantageous for what we're seeing right now in terms of development. But I think more importantly, what it goes to is the second point is the financial position of these innovative companies. If you look at the NASDAQ companies right now, 20 years ago, only half of them are profitable or generating positive free cash flow. If you fast forward to the end of last year, over 80% of these companies are profitable, generating positive free cash flow, and even in a net cash position. So we've totally flipped the tide around that these innovative companies are now very financially solid to sustain their R&D and to make it much more efficient. And I think the last point or the last converging factor is the acceptance of the wider market. We're seeing across all industries readily accepting AI as part of their business. And this is different. I mean, if you look at in the past, companies such as hardware rejected smartphones because they said it won't replace them. Brick and mortar rejected online because they were scared of it. This is the only time or rare time when the entire market is very willing to accept AI. So how I see it is we have very strong technology advancements, financially sound companies to innovate it, and a very accepting market.
That's fascinating. You know, I love how you brought in the economics of, you know, yeah, sure, you've got wonderful technology, but the price has fallen. So what does that, what implications does that have for the industry, but also for investors, right? And that makes a lot of sense. I'm conscious of keeping some of the questions that I have for you and the community will have for you for the webinar, which, by the way, anyone watching this or listening to this, you can find a link. The webinar is next week and it's free. You just come along and you can ask questions yourself as well. Given some of your background and time spent in Hong Kong, I was going to ask you a question. Is like a lot of what we talk about when we talk about technology or AI companies just does tend to center around like Silicon Valley and those big companies,
everything.
Big cloud computing companies, the big consumer technology companies. But as I was going through and learning about more of the companies in Asia, and an analyst on my team, Kevin, he recently took a trip to China and explored all of these types of businesses as well. I'm curious like how you think about companies like Alibaba, Baidu, these, you mentioned Tencent to me before. I was fascinated by this thing that Alibaba was working on called CityBrain. And I was just discovering all of these AI applications that are already underway in China and thinking there's got to be so much that investors are missing out on by simply focusing on like the West and the technology companies of the West. So I'm curious if you were to direct us to some of those companies or some of those projects or some things that you look at, even just a couple, what they would be.
Yeah, you're correct. I think just referring back to your observation, yes, Alibaba has a developed CityBrain, and it's actually been a while. It's actually been about 6 to 7 years that they've developed this. And this is essentially an urban management system where they're trying to use different cameras everywhere to optimize traffic, reduce congestion, and enhance public safety. And obviously, there's a concern about the big brother and privacy, but you know, there was, for example, that one actually reminds me of a very heartwarming story where Alibaba used the CityBrain images and they actually reunited a kid and its mother that was lost for about 10 years. You know, through imaging, they realized that this was the kid that's been missing, kidnapped for about a decade, and they actually found and reunited them. So there's a lot of use cases from this, and this has been made, you know, possible with all this development. And going back to your question about how far advanced or how advanced is China doing it, is they're actually making very big steps. So Alibaba, not just with the CityBrain, but they've also developed their own large language model. So just like Amazon, Google, and Facebook, they have a large language model, which they call the Tongyi Tianwen, which according to stats are actually already ahead of what we've seen with the Western peers as well. And not only have they, I guess, developed this or made advancements, but they're actually applying it into their services, which is very interesting because Alibaba, as you know, major e-commerce player in China and globally, and they're actually applying this into their e-commerce. So it's made their interface much stronger. People are selecting different goods much faster. And this has actually helped them in terms of actual P&L impact. So we're actually seeing this coming down to a P&L impact as well. And likewise with Baidu, Baidu is a very early developer of artificial intelligence in China. They've actually got a platform which is very similar to ChatGPT, which is what they call ErnieBot. ErnieBot. So ErnieBot's at close to it's past this 2.0 and it's still advancing. And again, a lot of the features and measurements are, you know, measuring up against GPT-3 or even GPT-4 as well. So they've made very strong advancements and they're actually applying this into their own businesses. So Baidu has an online search in China, which they're also applying their own ChatGPT or generative AI into it. And again, it is impacting their bottom line right now. So in China, we have companies which are already making these advancements and commercializing them as well.
Fascinating. I'm going to keep plugging you for ideas, but I'll probably do that next week when we have you back on the show and everyone can take part on the RAS YouTube channel. So please come along and check that out. You can talk about all different types of ETFs and technologies. Billy's obviously a wealth of knowledge and I'll be there to answer some questions as well. So maybe we'll leave people, because I've still got a few questions, but I'm going to leave them for next time. and give you a break, of course, as well. Let's not forget that. I've been drilling into you a fair bit, but I will ask for one final question. I'll ask you one final question, which is a question that I typically ask all of my new guests on the show, which is that if you could go back in time and tell yourself one thing about investing, what would it be?
Well, it would be start early. And I don't mean it in the sense that, oh, you start reading books early, start studying early. I don't mean in the sense that you should start trading early. It's nothing about that. What I mean is start taking risks early. And the reason is because, you know, risk is, you know, part of actually knowing investing. And I think, you know, one thing to start off is even just trading basketball cards when you're young, trading, you know, whatever, lollies when you're young. And the reason is because no textbook's ever going to teach you the gut-wrenching feeling of losing a trade. No textbook will ever teach you why you've done all this homework and the trade hasn't come out or the investment hasn't come out your way. You have to learn it the hard way. And I think one thing to do is to take risks early on when you can. And that makes you understand when you should actually size up or size down. And it gives you a much clearer picture of investment and it makes you prepare for what's to come in the markets. And I guess it's also a good way to look at life as well, right? I mean, there are times when things don't go right and you just have to understand that this is what the world is. And so I think I would definitely tell myself to take more risks, to understand it better, to understand when I'm younger and to take it when I'm younger.
I love that idea of calculated risk when you're younger and discovering the world.
Yes.
It's such a growth mindset from an early age can compound ferociously over a lifetime. And I think that's wonderful advice, mate. So I really do appreciate you taking some time out to answer all my AI and technology related questions. Clearly, anyone that listens to this would realize that your depth of knowledge is like superb. It's just really excellent, Billy. And I can't wait to explore more questions and more companies and ETFs and things with you next week. So I really do appreciate your time today. And thanks for joining me on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Owen. I really enjoy the conversation we had today as well.
Thanks.
For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called Rask Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. Rask Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. Rask Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the Rask Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.